Pretty, sir, depending on how he looks at it. I never knowed my father. My mother gave me up the parish when I was little, and sometimes they told me one thing, sometimes they told me another. So then, let's say you're 30. You have your health and strength now, but few seafaring men get much beyond 40 with those possessions still, certainly not on ships plying to the tropics. You know this yourself. You have not the look of a fool. Even if you last so long, what would there be for you on leaving the sea but rags and beggary? If you'll agree to conduct me to this place where you came upon the remains of my father's ship, I suppose you would be able to find it again. Yes, sir, I could find it. If you will take me there and show me the place, I swear you will not be sorry. You need never return to the sea if you do not wish to. I will take you into my service on good terms, or if you'd rather, I will give you a sum that will set you up in some business ashore. I'm a rich man, and what I say I will do, I will do. Anyone who knows me well will tell you that. I'm asking you for a year of your life, and offering to free you from want for the rest of it. Come, what do you say?
I say yes, sir, and trust I will give satisfaction, and God bless you for an open-handed gentleman.
Erasmus relaxed a little. He had offered more than he needed to, which was not a habit of his when bargaining, but he had been in fear that the man would refuse.
"It will take some 2 or 3 weeks for me to make arrangements," he said. "During that time you'll live here, and you will be dressed and fed. Then you will accompany me, as my servant, to the Florida coast. While in my house you will be expected to conduct yourself properly. You take my meaning?"
"Yes, sir."
"No drunkenness, no rowdiness, no harassment of the maids?"
"No, sir."
"You'll find me worse than any Indian if you get up to those tricks."
It was not often that Erasmus made witticisms of this or any other kind. Perhaps only relief could have produced this one. He was surprised almost to see a smile come to the other's face. It was a smile of considerable charm, broken-toothed, guileless, totally unabashed by the reference to his offence. And in it, Erasmus saw the beginning of a retribution, 12 years delayed.
"And you will speak to no one of this business," he said. "No living soul."
Chapter 39. There was much to see to, but not so much as he had feared. It is when we make plans for an absence that we learn the extent to which we are needed at home. A good deal of business had to be left in the hands of the junior partner, Andrews, but Erasmus's secretary was entirely familiar with the workings of the firm and could be trusted to guide and advise. The old man, Fletcher, was still active and hard-headed enough. He grumbled at having more to do, but made no real objection. Someone was found to deputise at meetings of the association. Many of the members had holdings in the West Indies, so prolonged absence from London was not uncommon. There was the chartering of a ship to see to, and letters of introduction had to be obtained for Colonel Campbell, the recently appointed governor of Florida. None of this presented much in the way of difficulty, but it took time. While waiting, he informed himself as far as he could about this new colony, acquired by accident almost. Spain had handed her over some 2.5 years previously to buy back her jewel of Cuba, taken by the English fleet. It seemed that what Phillips had said of her was largely true. The Spanish had never much valued the possession, except as safeguarding their trade routes from Mexico and the Caribbean. They had done little to develop the territory or even to explore it. It offered nothing, after all, to anyone's notions of usefulness. The southern part was an uncharted subtropical wilderness. There was no gold or silver to be found there, and any Indians that were captured soon died when enslaved, a fact that greatly reduced their value. During the latter part of the recent colonial wars, the Spanish had scarcely ventured from their capital of St. Augustine in the north, penned in by the warlike Creek Indians, who had been incited and supplied with arms by the English in Georgia. It was with the main task of pacifying these Creeks and assuring them of English gratitude that Campbell had been sent there, or such at least was the declared policy. Privately, Erasmus was given to understand that the expressions of gratitude would be accompanied by appropriations of traditional Creek hunting grounds to offer to English settlers. Harvey, meanwhile, kept to his side of the bargain and behaved well. Metamorphosed into a superior servant, in a suit of good cloth and paste buckles on his shoes, and his hair dressed in a pigtail, he entertained his fellow domestics with stories of the sea and aroused the beginnings of tenderness in the cook. He could still hardly believe his luck. He had entered a world where anything could happen. His new master was rich, the rich had unaccountable fancies, and Harvey was glad of it. Erasmus found a certain kind of happiness in this period of planning. His cause was just. A wrong had been done, and the perpetrators of it might be living still, while his own father had lain underground these 12 years. He said nothing of this, however, to anyone at all. To his associates, as to his wife and father-in-law, he explained the voyage as a business venture. This was plausible enough. Florida was a new colony. It was His Majesty's declared policy to encourage settlement by assisted passages and grants of land. Many could be expected to take advantage of this. There was certain to be a demand for manufactured goods. "I shall form useful connections up there in St. Augustine," Erasmus said to his father-in-law. "This new colony is a potential market of very great importance, I believe. Those who strike while the iron is hot will get the best share of it."
"Do you seriously think that Florida colonists will buy their sugar from us and pay the tariffs when they have Havana just across the water?"
Sir Hugo looked without friendliness at Erasmus from under white, dishevelled eyebrows.
"You must have taken leave of your senses," he said.
Erasmus met the old man's gaze with unconcealed antagonism. He had always been impatient of opposition, but of late years, with all his opinions confirmed by increasing wealth, that infallible testimony, any slightest criticism drove him to anger. "I was not talking of sugar," he said coldly. "Do you think there is naught but sugar in this world? Do you think people wear sugar on their backs or turn the earth with it? And if it is madness we are talking of, what is this indiscriminate buying of Negroes but madness? I'm reliably informed that your factors in Kingston are buying men with no mouth left, and women with dugs to their knees, and keeping them all in compounds with nothing to do.
The compensation we receive from the government will take no account of sick or whole. It will be paid on the number of heads and calculated on current prices." "Compensation?"
Erasmus affected a look of frigid puzzlement.
"Whence comes this notion? Some incubus must have visited your sleep. They are going to abolish the trade. It is coming, I tell you. There is a bill preparing now. I have it on authority. A parcel of clerks and petty fellows that hang about the ministries and sell information by the shilling," Erasmus said with contempt.
It was hardly believable that Gerald should give credence to such stories. He was a man whose shrewdness and ruthlessness were legendary, who had risen from lawyer's clerk to merchant banker and amassed a fortune on the way. He was worth 500,000 at least. In a lifetime of trading, he had scarcely touched anything that did not turn to profit. And to be visited now with this quite unfounded but unshakable fear of the abolitionists, which was like enough to ruin him. No, not fear, more like a need, something he was seeking. The intervention of God, perhaps. It was an unusual kind of thought for Erasmus, and he was uneasy at it, uneasy and perplexed. His father-in-law's career had, after all, been highly meritorious in its single-minded pursuit of wealth. Even now, in the shadow of this apocalypse of his own creating, the old man was trying to realize a profit.
"You will lose by it," Erasmus said. "A negro is valuable only in terms of the work that can be got out of him in the period immediately after purchase. He is not a capital asset. The merchandise is too perishable. It is not like cattle. You cannot breed him for profit. This movement for abolition of the trade is a chimera. There will be no bill. There are no voices against it but some few members of the Quaker faction and one or two meddling fools outside Parliament. But it is useless to talk to you."
The money being thus squandered might have ultimately come down to him through his wife. He had thought at one stage of trying to have the old man declared incompetent, but apart from this particular mania he seemed rational enough. The only thing to be hoped was that he might die soon and so limit the damage. Erasmus's own money, at least, was not in any danger. He had given instructions for his 12% holding in the bank to be quietly sold in small lots while the stock was still high. His farewells to his wife on the day of departure were scant in the extreme. He was embarking that evening. The coach was waiting below, with Harvey and the baggage already inside. He had to wait while Marie announced him. His wife had lately decided, or been told by one of her friends, that too much ease of access between married persons was vulgar. As he entered, Fritz the poodle yapped at him as usual from its cushion and showed its pink gums. A travestied and unrecognizable woman in a peach-coloured gown, her features concealed behind a mask of greyish, pimpled skin, reclined on a sofa in the dressing room adjacent to the bedchamber.
"Is that you, Margaret?" he said, advancing. "What in God's name is that in your face?"
"It is a chicken skin," she replied, in a voice slightly obscured. "I'm advised by my friend Lady Danby that it is the non plus ultra for restoring one's complexion."
The ragged fringe of skin round her mouth moved with the movement of her lips.
"It has to be a freshly killed bird so as to be moist enough."
"So your husband, who is to be away several months, is to make his farewells to a chicken skin?"
"I cannot see why you should need to look at my face just because you are going away, when you take such small interest in it while you are under the same roof. This must be kept in place for an hour at least, so Lady Danby says, if it is to do anything."
"Lady Danby is little better than a whore, and I'm sorry to hear you call a friend," Erasmus said. "I cannot wait that long. We are sailing with the tide."
He took her listless hand and kissed it.
"I hope you'll take care of your health," he said. "Your complexion, I see, is in no danger of neglect."
In the coach, as they jolted past Tower Bridge, it occurred to Erasmus that his wife must have donned the chicken skin shortly before his visit, though she had known he was coming. She had wanted to conceal herself. Her complaint against him had some truth in it. On the occasions, rare enough now, when they slept together, he did not look much at her face. At all other times when they met, she was masked or disguised in some way, with fard and rouge and patches, or with some charlatan lotion. It came to him that he almost never saw Margaret's real face. He wondered if he would recognize her passing in the street or in the midst of a crowd. There was one face he would know instantly, after 12 years or 20, the green eyes, so pale as to seem like some solution of silver, the deeply marked brows, the patience and obstinacy of the expression. With a sudden rush of detestation, Erasmus realized that he knew this face of Matthew Paris more intimately than that of any other person in the world. It was a face that returned frequently to him during the voyage, accompanied always by further remembered details of his cousin's appearance and manner, this process resembling a story he repeated to himself, more elaborate with every repetition. But wherever the story began, it ended always in the same place, with those stronger arms lifting him, swinging him away, violating his body and his will. He had uttered no sound, submitting in furious silence, making himself a dead weight in his cousin's arms. He recalled Paris's appearance on that last visit, the gaunt and awkward frame, the thick wrists and clumsy-seeming hands that were yet so precise in their smallest movements, the deep voice with the odd vibration in it, and the sardonic, lopsided smile. There had been that disturbing suggestion of physical power, of imperfect control. The possibility that this face, this bundle of attributes, should have continued in being all this while, surviving his father's ruin, his own loss of love and home, and all the long struggle to pay off his father's debts, was something he found difficult at first to endure. That the survival had been achieved by such heinous crimes, murder, piracy, the theft not only of the Negroes but of the ship itself, and then only to abandon her, made it the more monstrous. The thought that his cousin might be alive still was literally monstrous to him, a shape of ugliness and deformity in the natural order of things, something to be extirpated. It subverted all the rules that men lived by. If such wrongdoing was allowed to succeed, what price duty, what price honour, what price his own faithful discharge of obligation to the family name? But as the days at sea followed one another in monotonous succession, with the wash of waves against the ship's bows and the slow creaking of her timbers, he found himself in the strengthening grip of paradox. The less Paris seemed deserving of liberty and life, the more Erasmus found himself hoping that he was still in possession of these, so that he could be brought to justice and deprived of both together. For the other miscreants who had been aboard, whom Paris had doubtless persuaded to join him, Erasmus cared little. They were scum in any case. but his thoughts tended always to a passionate preservation of his cousin's life, until the fear that he was not there, that he might not be able to be found, even that the whole story might still prove to be a fabrication, set him burning with a fever of anxiety as he lay sleepless on his narrow bunk, rocked tirelessly by this barren mother who could give him no security, no relief. The chafing of the sheets brought him to sexual arousal sometimes, a mechanical tension that was like a transference of his tense will. At these times he brought himself to a cold release and lay empty, waiting for dawn. As the leagues mounted between himself and what he had left, the years fell away, became unreal, and he returned to the elemental feelings of childhood. His life dwindled to one intense focus, of such simplicity and power that it reduced the rest to shadows. This falling away was like the slow dismantling of a scaffolding that had never been necessary, but he could not discern the structure it had supported, or seemed to support. That, too, was an illusion. There was the intense and brilliant focus of his resolve. Outside of this, little was visible to him. The blankness of sky and ocean seemed evidence only of more stripping away. But in lieu of possession and identity, there was the notion of justice, which deepened and grew abstract and religious, renewed every day in the promise of the dawn, confirmed by the simple sunlight, solemnized by the approach of the dark. Harvey he questioned from time to time, and always closely, as if intent to find him out in some contradiction. But the seaman's story was too simple for that, and at the same time too vague. Harvey had no picture in his mind of the route that had led him to the creek. He had blundered onto it. "I take drink, sir," he said, always with the same expression, wry and philosophical, as befitted references to this common accident of the human condition. He could remember, so he said, the watering place and the general lie of the coast where they had anchored, and indeed he felt pretty sure of this. Though apprehensive of failure, he knew his master well enough by now not to relish the thought of disappointing him. However, he was not a man who worried over much, and he was otherwise enjoying the voyage mightily. It was the first time in his life that he'd been at sea without having to sweat at the ropes. He messed with the steward and other crew members exempted from watch, and regaled them with extraordinary stories about the world of fashion into which he had been introduced. His own simple wonder disarmed his listeners, and he was popular with everyone aboard. The same wonder governed his relations with his employer. That a man with a fine house and servants and money, in short, everything he needed in life, should want to go halfway round the world merely to look at a stinking hulk in a creek bed was so far from reasonable, so opaque to normal understanding, that it placed Kemp on a different level of humanity altogether. Lordly, superbly unaccountable, needing to be humoured like the mad. This humouring Harvey took seriously, conceiving it his duty, part of the terms of his engagement. His story gained in fluency and dramatic colouring without acquiring much more in the way of substance. It was also refined in the direction of virtue. Someone else had drawn off the rum from the ship's stores. Someone else, again, had been for trying to catch the women. To the discovery itself he could add little. The elements, after all, were few. The drink, the headlong chase, the stumbling through the mangrove swamp, the curving bank of the channel, and the tilted wreck lying there amid the debris of her masts, the vegetation trailing over her from the banks on either side. Sometimes he added details. "She was a slave ship," he said once. "I'd been on slavers. There was the remains of the bulkheads marking off the rooms." At the same time, he tried to defend himself against possible mistake. "That bit of coast," he said, "it never looks the same. Sometimes it ain't even the coast you're seeing. You see what looks like land, but it is only shapes of mist built up on the horizon, and they disappears as you come closer in." As they passed through the Santarin Channel and out into the Florida Stream, these words came to seem prophetic. They struck a season of wandering and irregular mists, warm air above the current meeting with colder on the edges. Through these they loitered for some days, with the low green shapes of the Keys, glimpsed intermittently on the port side, vivid and brief enough to seem like hallucinations. Anxious to avoid the shoals to eastwards, the captain kept in mid-channel until they were north of the Great Bahama Bank, then approached the Florida coast at the rough latitude of the Bocanueva, the only landmark Phillips had supplied, and so far invisible in the continuing mists. He did not dare go in too close. The only charts they had were Spanish, well drawn enough, but not to be relied on, the configuration of the coast in this southeastern part having undergone constant change as the sea nibbled at it.
"It is like a flabby old prick hanging down, getting wore away all the time,"
Harvey remarked in a moment of gloom to the steward, after studying the map of the peninsula,
"with poxy Spanish names on it, which no Christian can read."
He could not read in any language, but this did not lessen his sense of aggrievement. However, next morning they woke to clear weather, and a succession of fine days followed. They drew closer to the coast, and made gradual way northwards with the current, scanning the shores as they went. Towards noon on the second day of this, they sighted the green mouth of the Entrada, with its long, curving sandbar on the north side, where the sea broke white in the shape of a sickle, just as Phillips had described. They anchored in 10 fathoms, and the shore party put out in the punt, with provisions for 2 days. Erasmus, Harvey, and 6 of the crew armed with musket and cutlass. It was a day of clear sunshine, almost windless. The shore and the scrub beyond were completely deserted. Low waves broke on the sand with scarcely any sound at all. Erasmus was never to forget the sense of terrible incongruity that descended on him as he stepped out of the boat onto the white sand and felt the peace of the place settle round him. Before him, the beach sloped gently upwards to a fringe of motionless palms. A flock of birds with black wings and white faces and crimson blade-like bills rose and flew out to sea, keeping low over the water, making no sound. Here, he thought, or somewhere not far, perhaps on a day like this one, the fugitives had made landfall. It was hardly possible to believe it. There was no print of man anywhere to be seen. He began to walk up the beach. Feeling firm ground under his feet, he staggered slightly after the weeks at sea, but the unsteadiness seemed to him due more to the shock of this hush that lay over everything. He came to a stop, glancing in something like bewilderment along the empty shore, with nothing in his mind but his own loneliness and the incongruous violence of his intentions. Such faltering was unusual, and it did not last long. If anything, his resolution was strengthened by the difficulties that followed. It emerged that Harvey could not immediately locate the place where they had watered. He would know it when he saw it, he said, in an attempt to deflect his employer's wrath, but he could see nothing directly before him, here on the shoreline, to indicate which direction it lay in. Since all he knew for sure was that the place lay south of the inlet, Erasmus judged it best to take the point of their landing as central and seek north and south from it along the coast. Creeks there were in plenty, running into the wetlands behind the shore, but they were not the streams of Harvey's memory. It took 2 days of casting thus, with their escort now openly surly at being made to row long hours in the sun, before they came upon the stretch of slightly higher, rockier shore, scattered with pines, that Phillips had described and Harvey now recognised. The springs were here, right enough. There was fresh water below the ground over a wide area, emerging in pools among the rocky scrub. As if to compensate for his failure before, Harvey now led without hesitation, skirting the pools, plunging into the mangrove thickets that grew beyond them. Sweating profusely, stumbling among the intricate roots of the trees, sometimes floundering knee-deep in swamp, they kept a rough course between the shore and a chain of small brackish lagoons that ran parallel to it. The mouth of the creek, when they came to it, was dark as a cavern, roofed over with branches. There was no more than a foot or two of water in it, almost black and quite still, half choked in places with spreads of heavily scented hyacinth-like flowers. Keeping as close as possible to the bank, they followed the channel as it wound inland. A crocodile, which had been sunning itself in a break among the trees, slithered without apparent haste down the bank side, broke the dark water into brief glitters, and disappeared among a tangle of bushes. The creek began a wide curve away from the sea. Quite unexpectedly, following this round, they came upon the ship. She lay where the retreating water had left her, keel embedded in the mud bottom. In settling, she had leaned heavily to port, and the refuse of her decks had piled against the gunwales on that side. Creepers had found their way over her bows and clothed the ruined trellis of the forecastle railing. Drapes of pale green moss, like horses' tails, had lowered onto her from the trees that arched overhead. Thick-stemmed vines had lassoed the stumps of her masts. Only the upper slope of her quarter-deck was left bare. She was tied down here, bound by the lacing of creepers, a rotting captive in this forgotten channel. From somewhere on the opposite bank, Erasmus heard the sudden chattering cry of a bird. The smell of salt, mud, and vegetable decomposition came to him, and the smell of the softened, worm-riddled timbers of the ship. He walked forward until he came level with her bows. There was the Duchess of Devonshire, eyeless and cracked and faded now, and her bosom crumbling, but still yearning forward in her pinions. She was turned away towards the further bank. Some distant ebb had tugged the ship athwart the stream. Boarding would be easier by the stern, he decided, where she was closer up. "I want no one with me," he said. "You men will wait here. Space out along the bank and keep a watch." These words came as a disappointment to Harvey, who had hoped to accompany his master aboard. He had convinced himself that there was something of immense value on the ship, which only Kemp knew about, this being the only thing he could think of that could explain what they were doing there. All he got in the event, however, was mud on his back from Erasmus's boots. The ship's side was rather far for a leap, especially as she was tilted so awkwardly. Too impatient to wait for a bridge to be made, Erasmus swung over to the stern post by means of a rope, using Harvey's back as a launching pad. Taking advantage of the footholds afforded by the carving of the quarterheads, he climbed up over the side, encountering as he did so the raddled, reproachful stare of the merchant, still in periwig and cocked hat, still with hectic traces of red in his cheeks. Above this, affording an excellent toehold, was the scroll of the City of Liverpool, in blistered gilt. A final effort brought him onto the deck. Here he stood, clear in the sunshine. He heard faint scuttling sounds from among the warm boards. A delicately fronded, fern-like plant grew thickly amidst the burst planking of the deck, where the rotted wood had mixed with leaf mould and drifted dust to make a soil. With a small shock of surprise, he heard the humming of bees from somewhere, and moments later two tiny buff-coloured birds flew up out of this undergrowth and disappeared among the foliage on the opposite bank. He began to make his way forward, moving crabwise along the slope of the deck. A debris of broken staves and a section of mast lay over the after-hatch, too heavy for him to lift aside. He went on towards the main hatchway. He saw a snake, dandified as only the very venomous can be, in bands of red and black and yellow, go slithering across some feet of open deck and disappear below a pile of broken casks and scraps of cordage. He drew the cutlass at his side and went forward. The intensity of his purpose was near to choking him now. He would have braved any danger to get below and find his cousin's cabin, though what he expected to see there he did not know. The hatchway was open, though partly grown over with bindweed. The stairs were in place, leading down. At the foot, he began to make his way aft again, leaning awkwardly against the portside bulkhead to keep his balance against the tilt. Shafts of light came through from the gaps in the planking overhead. Some yards along, he found a skull and a scattering of bones, part of the rib cage still in its hoop. Had Phillips mentioned human remains on the ship? He could not remember. An adult, this, but whether black or white it was not possible to determine. Hardly big enough to belong to Paris, there were two more skeletons, one of them a child's, lying a little further, at an angle to the bulkhead. The discovery, his aloneness in these unaccustomed surroundings, took all guard from his thoughts. As he stood in this dim, cluttered place, he could not defend himself against the knowledge that there had been terrible suffering here, in the heart of the ship. It was as though the timbers gave off the odour of it. It had survived this ruin, would survive the dust the ship was destined to. This was no more than an aberration, a brief deflection of purpose. Next moment he was shuffling on again, through the broken sunlight. He had been over the vessel often enough with his father to remember where the surgeon's quarters lay, but the dimensions of the cabin were not so easy to make out now. The light inner bulkhead had fallen in, as if from some splintering blow. There was a litter of old yarn and bits of tackle that had jolted down here with the tilt of the ship. But the frame of the bunk was still there, loose at the foot, where it had swung free from the splintered partition. Erasmus kicked at the rubbish, dislodged a rusted band of iron and some pieces of curved wood, saw beneath these a curled shape, a snake, he thought at first, then saw it was part of a belt. He picked it up. The leather had rotted, and the buckle was missing, perhaps cut off. It was narrow, not a seaman's belt. He began to look about him with more purpose. Below, where the planking had buckled and split, he found a glass stopper with a round lid, of the type apothecaries use for small bottles and phials. This mark of his cousin's presence was as precious to him as a token of love, and he pocketed it with care. However, apart from a small china inkwell, he found nothing more of any interest. It was clear that the cabins had been diligently picked over, and probably more than once. On the point of leaving, obscurely disappointed, he pushed with a sort of vindictive violence against the frame of the bunk. He felt the head of it swing heavily round, then check against the splintered bulkhead. There was some obstruction there, something reinforcing the partition. Forcing the frame as far as possible from the wall, he saw a small cavity there, which had perhaps been fronted with panelling or some light veneer. He could see nothing inside. There was not light enough, and he was unwilling to put his hand where his eye could not follow it. He found a piece of wood and poked with it in the cavity. His stick encountered some object there that took up nearly all the space. When he reached in, his fingers touched the side of a wooden box. It seemed to him afterwards that he had known from the first touch what this box would be, so that when he drew it out there was no surprise, only a sense of confirmation. The lacquer was roughened and pitted, but the resinous varnish had held off the damp, and the gold and blue design of peacocks on the lid was as clear now in this narrow space where he stood as it had been the afternoon 13 years ago, when amid the teacups and the talk of her ailments, his mother had made a present of it to Matthew Paris. He remembered with absolute clarity the quality of the light, the gown his mother had worn, his cousin's courteous gravity, in which there seemed always something sardonic, and his large hands taking the box. Holding it carefully, he went some paces forward to where the sunlight shafted through from gaps in the deck above. There was no lock, but the wood had warped. He had to use some force to open the lid. Inside was a loose sheaf of papers and a stoutly bound book, edged with red leather. A glance at this told him that it was a journal of some kind. The pages were covered with the angular writing he recognised as his cousin's. The loose sheets, too, bore his cousin's hand. There were words and phrases crossed out here and there. He took a sheet at random, raised it to the light, and looked at the first few lines. Thus it is that while the heart remains unharmed, life can chance to be restored to all parts and health recovered, but if the heart be either chilled or affected with some grievous ill, it must needs be that the whole animal will suffer and fall into corruption. Erasmus looked up towards the source of light. There was a spider's web directly above him, the strands dusty-looking in the sunlight, the fawn-coloured host motionless in the centre. Vaguely at first, then with a sudden tightening of the throat, he remembered how his father had enjoyed singing Paris's praises, how delighted he had been to be sending such a well-qualified surgeon with the ship. Among these accomplishments of his nephew had been the fact that he was translating a medical work from Latin, a treatise on the heart. Erasmus could hear the voices of the men stationed on the bank. The angle of the sun had changed in this brief space of time. The light fell now directly on his face. The web was in shadow, scarcely visible. Within these rotting bowels of the ship, he sensed a life that had cautiously resumed. Faint scurrying sounds, minute displacements. This crumbling structure, coffin of his father's hopes. But it was Paris who had deserted him, left him to die in ignorance. This box, which had been a parting gift, these papers, he had not forgotten them, not overlooked them. He had left them here because they belonged to a life that was over, one to which he had not intended to return. Either that, or he had been no longer among the living when the ship was drawn up here. Erasmus replaced the papers, closed the lid. One or the other it must be. It was the doubt that had brought him so far. If his cousin was dead, the ledger could be closed. If he were alive, he had to be found and hanged. Somewhere in this wilderness they might be still, those who had survived. The stories of the Indians came to his mind. Stories or legends, Phillips had not seemed sure. They would never have stayed here among the swamps. They would have made for higher, drier ground. Unlikely they had gone so very far, hampered and burdened as they must have been, and in such difficult terrain. His mind moved among possibilities with an insistent logic. They might not have stayed together. They might have scattered, gone their different ways, but there was safety in numbers. They might have made northwards in a body for Georgia or Louisiana, but that would have meant hundreds of miles through Spanish territory, with hostile Indians all along the northern borders. Could the remnants of the crew have abandoned the Negroes and escaped by sea, perhaps to Cuba or Hispaniola? But he did not believe it. He was convinced, in a way that went beyond logic, that this ingrate jailbird cousin of his had compounded his crimes and made his disgrace complete by siding not only with the mutinous scum of the crew, but with the runaway blacks as well. The conviction transcended his hatred for Paris. That high sense of justice that he had experienced during the voyage returned to him now. "It is not finished," he said in a low, impulsive mutter. Once more, he lifted his face to the broken sunlight. "The debts are not paid yet. If he is alive, I will find him." As always, he gathered his surroundings to him, took them to witness. He promised the silence and dilapidation around him, the whole rotting hulk of the ship, that he would find his renegade cousin wherever he was skulking. Find him, and see him hanged. Chapter 40. As soon as Erasmus Kemp had rejoined the ship, she weighed and set a course northwards for St. Augustine. In the southwesterly land breeze she made good time. Erasmus stood at the rail scanning the coast through a telescope, but he saw no sign of human habitation. Only the pale stretches of the shore and the low line of scrub beyond it, broken occasionally by dark, dome-shaped belts of forest like sudden islands. When they were still south of Cape Canaveral, the wind veered eastward, obliging them to stand further out for fear of the shoals, and he lost all sight of the coast. Late in the afternoon, after some hesitation, he settled down to look at the journal. Some reluctance he did not fully understand, some fear of being mastered, held him back, though he was conscious of no curiosity in regard to his cousin's thoughts and feelings, only of the desire to find evidence of his crimes. He began at the later pages. Evidence would be here, if anywhere. The ink had faded badly in places, and mould had attacked the edges of the leaves here and there, but a good deal was legible still. He turned the leaves, his eyes moving impatiently over the obliterated passages. The journal gave off the faint, sweetish perfume of neglect. "Perhaps, seeing some advantage to be gained from me as the owner's nephew, a matter he refers to frequently and with significant inflections. He is sniffing for a source of power, or preparing to shift allegiance. Certainly Thurzo may not now be such a star to follow. Feeling among the people against him is strong. It can be sensed in the men's looks and mutterings among themselves. Kavanagh has scarce said a word since the casting overboard of his monkey." A favourable wind, But the terrible deity who may have sustained Thurso all these years of his trading for slaves shows himself whimsical at last, as we see in these calms that have descended on us, and keep us still among the shoals with seldom enough wind to give the ship steerage way, for she is now so foul she will not feel a small breeze. April 20. Woke this morning to strains of Nancy Dawson, played by Sullivan for the negroes to dance to. It is in his face that he does not much relish this use to which his music is put, but Thurso, considerations of humanity, but for the sake of his prime, that is, the 4% promised him by my uncle on every slave reaching Jamaica and sold there. I care not if we never reach Jamaica, nor any. Dancing will not keep them alive while the bloody flux moves among them. This demon was with us when we set sail from the coast, and grows apace, in spite of all my efforts to air and fumigate their rooms below deck. Almost every morning now we bring up dead, shackled to the living. Yesterday one of the women was delivered of a dead baby, which Libby threw over the side. April 26. I continue, in spite of these terrible conditions, to hold long conversations with Delblanc, and they're a solace to me, though I think him not enough of a realist. He maintains there could be a world, a society, without victims and without injustice, where the weakness of one was not an invitation to the strength of another, except to succour or protect. I go so far with him as to believe it true that the moral character of man is formed by what happens to him in the world, and that our nature originates in external circumstances. Why, then, do we languish under wars and tyrannies? Delblanc would say it is due to the harmful effect of government upon us, government being powerful for evil only, and powerless for conditions on this ship, one would be bound to agree. We are a sick and disaffected body of men, with a human cargo constantly dwindling, presided over by a man who grows every day more mad in appearance, hoarse and staring, with congested-looking features, and accompanied always. Flogged a man today, only for going to complain about the condition of the salt beef, which is black and glazed over and clearly putrid, as I have myself verified. Barton sends those he does not favour to scrape and swab out the slaves' quarters, a task much hated by reason of the poor creatures sometimes being so enfeebled by the flux as not to have strength to reach the necessary buckets. There are four of these in each of the apartments. It often happens that those who are placed at a distance from the buckets, in endeavouring to get to them, tumble over their companions in consequence of their being shackled. These accidents, though unavoidable, are productive of continual quarrels, in which some of them are always bruised. In this situation, unable to proceed and prevented from going to the tubs, they desist from the attempt, and as the necessities of nature are not to be resisted, they ease themselves as they lie. There followed now several pages which some particular wear or friction, or perhaps the poorer quality of the ink, had rendered illegible. Erasmus felt hot and half-stifled in the close confines of the cabin. The sweetish smell that rose from the pages came like some repugnant claim on him. He had retrieved this record from its journey to dust, and the rescue seemed to make him, for the moment, his cousin's accomplice. Perhaps in the final pages Paris might have written something to incriminate himself. The writing here was more hasty and ragged, though still, for the most part, clear enough. This morning, we consigned to the sea Evans, who had been declining these 2 weeks past with a low fever, and died on deck. Also, two slaves, a man of the bloody flux, and a boy of the gravel and stoppage of the urine, thus bringing McGann in irons for the second time, for begging rice from the negroes' bowls. Now that supplies are running low, the slaves get more than the crew, which is reasonable from Thurso's point of view, since he has no hope of selling the latter, and may save their wages if they die. Water, too, is growing scarce. The men are rationed to 1 pint a day. McGann is sick with scurvy, but his appetite seems not to be affected. On being detected, he was beaten by Barton with a rope's end, then set in irons on the deck. He sits there in his shackles with his face screwed up tight, and the red bonnet, which he has worn all the voyage, still hanging over his brow. Not far from death, in my judgment, but still has not relented in the matter of his wager with Sullivan. He is not the only one of our people to beg thus. I have been surprised to see the negroes give sometimes from their own portions, notwithstanding the grievous condition they are themselves in. It cannot be pity. How could they pity the men who have brought them to this pass? Crew and slaves are in the embrace of a wretchedness so profound that it precludes all animosity, all personal. My cabin here, I can hardly breathe in the mid-parts of the day, and seek what breezes I can get on the weather side. The stench of the ship is truly terrible. There is not only the reek that rises from the bilges, but the smell of the slave quarters grows daily less supportable, for all our applications of vinegar and sulphur. My fancies grow sick. I feel the breeding of disease in the pores of her timbers, and we are a foul breath on the ocean that bears us. May 15. Not only fancies are bred in these days, but memories dredged up, as it were, from the sea. I have been thinking much of you lately, and of our child that we never saw. It haunts my thoughts that you cried out for me and I was not there. Worse than this, against all reason, and yet beyond my power to suppress, there is the fear that you are there in the crowd, that you saw me, head and hands thrust forward in that grotesque position, my face bleeding and fouled. And it was this memory of my face that you carried to the grave, while yours, in my memory, is flawless, and these ugly thoughts, my dearest. I know that if I had not persisted in publishing my opinions, which I did out of arrogance, into prison and ruin. Because of this I took Kemp's offer, not from any necessity of a material nature, but from the necessity of my shame. Regard myself as valueless, as disposable for any purpose, however unworthy. Throw my life away, but I have been brought with despair to see that this was the same self-regard as before. I have assisted in the suffering inflicted on these innocent people, and in so doing joined the ranks of those that degrade the unoffending. This has been my crime, and I am more guilty in it than the common seaman, who can plead the dire necessity of... Erasmus closed the book with sudden violence. He understood better now the initial reluctance he had felt. Reading had brought his cousin too close. In some such cramped and narrow space as this, where he himself was now, Paris must have written the words. His image came through them, undimmed by the years, the awkward, heavy-shouldered form in its clerical black, the lined face with its look of obstinate patience. He had suffered. Erasmus felt the touch of an intolerable compassion. At the same time, he could hardly believe what he had been reading. It struck him as verging on madness. This wild confession, this owning to a crime so outlandish, so totally different from the true ones of mutiny and theft of the negroes, outraged him with its insolence and perversity. In the conflict of these feelings, Erasmus was swept by doubt and loneliness. His whole being seemed under threat of dissolution. What became of law, of legitimacy, of established order, if a man could assume such attitudes of private morality, decide for himself where his fault lay? It turned everything upside down. He could think of nothing more damnable. And yet he remembered suddenly the second, rarer smile his cousin had, the one that came slowly, transforming his face. Briefly, unwillingly, Erasmus glimpsed the possibility of freedom. His face and hands felt hot, feverish almost. He went to the water jug on his narrow table and washed, cupping the cold water in his hands and throwing it repeatedly up into his face. After this, feeling the need for air, he mounted to the deck and found a sky still smouldering in the aftermath of sunset. Embers of cloud glowed in the east, and there were long rifts of fire low over the sea. He stood at the rail, breathing deeply, watching the flame die slowly to colours of cinders and ash, allowing his knowledge of his cousin's wickedness to return and comfort him. Chapter 41. On the second day following, helped by the constant flow of the stream and a fair wind from the southeast, they drew level with Anastasia Island, and by the middle of the afternoon, crossing the bar at high tide, they had anchored in the harbour of St. Augustine. Turned out as elegantly as conditions at sea permitted, in a cocked hat and dove-grey suit, and accompanied by Harvey in sober black and a powdered pigtail, Erasmus stepped onto the quayside to find himself being saluted by a young lieutenant of dragoons, resplendent in full-dress uniform, waiting for him beside an ancient, creaking four-wheeler. Word of the ship's approach had come post from Anastasia Island, the lieutenant explained, flicking with his gloves at the cracked leather seats of the coach. The governor was detained in the port at present over some business with stores. He apologised for the state of the conveyance, but there was nothing better to be found, the Spanish having allowed things to run down to a degree quite shocking. With the colony now in British hands, things would very soon be improved. At a pace consistent with the powers of their skinny horses and ragged, consumptive-looking driver, they proceeded over the bridge and causeway spanning the estuary of the St. Sebastian River, with the decayed fortress of St. Mark, built by the Spanish, looming up across the flat, marshy landscape. The city was built along a narrow ridge of land between marsh and river mouth, and lay a good 2 miles from the ocean, though within sight of the bar and lighthouse. The lieutenant, who was very young, had been instructed to make himself agreeable to the distinguished visitor from England, and he strove to fulfil his instructions, pointing out features of the landscape, apologising yet again for the governor's absence. Colonel Campbell had left word he would be back within the hour. Would Mr. Kemp care to wait at the residence? The lieutenant ventured to think they could make him tolerably comfortable. Erasmus considered. He had never taken easily to waiting, and there would be some advantage, slight but ponderable, in having himself properly announced and received, rather than appearing to wait on the governor's pleasure. They had entered now the precincts of the city, a pleasant, well-shaded avenue led between gardens and orange groves. "If you will be good enough to set me down in the principal square," he said, "I will walk for an hour and view the town." The offer of an escort was declined with polite firmness. In a short while, Erasmus was sauntering through the lanes that ran north and south, parallel to the seawall, Harvey a pace behind, laden with his sword and his gloves and the small box containing his letters of introduction, and soon, since the afternoon sun was still hot, his coat and hat. He was struck by the silence and abandonment of the place. There were no surfaced roads, there were no pavements or sidewalks. The houses were built in the Spanish style, with projecting balconies and latticed verandas. Time and weather had softened their colours and crumbled the walls surrounding their neglected gardens. For the most part they were shuttered and silent. The whole city lay under the hush of desertion. The stores in the square were boarded. A few listless Indians sat on the steps of the Spanish mission church. He encountered small groups of red-coated soldiers in the garrison, but no European civilians at all. The British, it seemed, had taken over an empty city. It was early evening when he presented himself at the residence, a white Spanish-style mansion of good proportions facing to the sea. He was conducted to the drawing-room, where he found Campbell, together with another man, an officer in uniform, awaiting him. He delivered his letters and expressed himself delighted to make the governor's acquaintance.
"And are yours, sir?" the governor said. "Now I bid you heartily welcome here in our new colony of Florida."
He was a lean, wiry man with an energetic manner and the accents of his native Banffshire. His eyes were small and watchful, and they held a twinkling light.
"I have the honour to present Major Redwood, the commander of our garrison here," he said. "Your servant, sir."
The major brought his heels together with a jingle of spurs. He was big and fair-browed, with a good-humoured, careless face.
"We have a damn good brandy here," he said, "if you want to celebrate being on terra firma again. I hate ships myself. The Spanish left a cellarful of it. Just about all they did leave, apart from rusty cannon and dying Indians." "Come, Redwood, we must not give our visitor the wrong impression."
This had been said with a smile, but Erasmus heard the note of reproof and understood it perfectly. He was swift and acute where his interest was involved. There were two different types of men before him here, and the difference might be useful.
"We should drink to them for leaving it," he said with a smile of good fellowship for Redwood. "Then another bumper in gratitude to them for taking themselves off and allowing us to drink in peace."
This was a sentiment that appealed to the Major, who broke into a loud laugh. Erasmus turned back to the Governor.
"They could not take this happy climate away with them," he said, "nor the fertility of the soil."
Campbell showed some cautious pleasure at this.
"You're right, sir," he said. "I perceive you to be a man of sense and observation. Why, you can get 3 crops of vegetables a year out of this soil, and figs and oranges in abundance. This could be a paradise, if settled with subjects of King George and properly cultivated."
"Let us drink to that, and be damned to the dons," Erasmus said, raising his glass.
"You are proposing to remain some time with us, I believe,"
Campbell said, after they had drunk. His small, twinkling eyes rested steadily on Erasmus for some seconds.
"Such, at least, is my hope," he added.
"You are very good, sir. Yes, some little time. There is much of interest here, and I shall need to inform myself before I can make a full report to my partners in London as to the prospects for development in the colony."
Campbell nodded with the vigour characteristic of all his movements. When he spoke, however, his voice was softer and the Scottish accent more clearly audible.
"Yes, sir, we shall hope you carry away with you a favourable impression, but perhaps there is something more particular that you will be requiring from us."
Erasmus sipped his brandy. There had been more than politeness in this inquiry. It was almost as if the other were reaching for an accommodation between them already. Campbell's a shrewd fellow, by no means the simple soldier he might have wanted to be thought.
"There are things we might profitably discuss, sir, by and by," he said, "time and your other engagements permitting." "In the meantime, what do you say to some more brandy?"
Redwood said, turning towards the sideboard. He moved lightly for a man of his bulk.
"'Twill evaporate completely, if left too long."
"You will stay with us here, of course, for the length of your visit,"
the Governor said.
"I dare say we can make you rather more comfortable than you will have been aboard ship."
Erasmus made some demur, but not much. He had been expecting the offer. He was engaged to dinner and shown his quarters, while Harvey, who had just discovered a source of grog below stairs and had begun to harbour designs on a serving girl with Spanish brows and Indian colouring, was dispatched back to the ship for some further necessities of his master's. There were only the 3 of them at dinner. An orderly in uniform served them quail pie and roast venison and an assortment of fresh vegetables, accompanied by a good burgundy. Erasmus commented on the excellence of the meal.
"We owe it to Redwood,"
Campbell said, glancing at the Commandant with his usual careful, close-mouthed geniality. The Major, it was now explained, had been in charge of the British occupation force when the colony was handed over by the Spanish, and had served as administrator until the Governor's arrival 18 months later. A good deal of his time had been spent on food, one way and another, organising field kitchens for the garrison, recruiting and training kitchen staff for the residents, ensuring a supply of fresh meat and vegetables from the surrounding countryside.
"Well, my congratulations, sir," Erasmus said. "The results do you credit."
Much of what Campbell had just been telling him he knew already, though he was careful to give no indication of this. In his usual methodical way, he had made inquiries before leaving England, and he knew more about both men than either would have suspected. As they sat after dinner on the terrace with their brandy and cigars, he reviewed this knowledge in his mind. Redwood had been a professional soldier from the age of 18 when he had joined as an ensign in a regiment of infantry. Since then, he had seen service in a dozen campaigns. He was brave, competent, perhaps not greatly ambitious, though he would doubtless be hoping for promotion now, after his services in this interim period. He struck Erasmus as a man who would do much for the sake of friendship, or even from a careless kind of generosity. Not so Campbell. He thought again about the Governor's record. A cavalryman by training, he had fought with Cumberland against his fellow Scots, and held a command under Ligonier in the expeditionary force to Flanders. He had come to North America in 1757 and fought the French and their Indian allies in Pennsylvania and South Carolina. In 1761 he had helped in the defeat and decimation of the Cherokee nation, distinguishing himself as much by his adroit manipulation of rivalries among the tribes as by his skill in the field. His present post was a recognition of these services to the Crown. He would need all his diplomacy now, since the main task facing the new administration was to persuade the fierce and numerous Creek Indians to the north and west of them to surrender large tracts of their territory. Campbell had risen on a certain kind of shrewd and dogged merit, without great influence or favour. He would not want to make enemies at home now. The knowledge of all this was present to Erasmus as he sat there at his ease in the warm evening, with the land breeze bringing a scent of